Zuga lowered the pistol and used the wall to hoist himself to his feet. He stood there swaying, his head hanging, the pistol dangling from his hand that was suddenly so weak that he could barely support its weight.
"Master Zuga!"
Jan Sharut dashed into the yard, panting from his run, carrying the Lee Enfield rifle at high port across his chest, sweat streaking down from under his brimless pillbox infantry cap, and his face crumpling with dismay as he saw Zuga's bloody, torn face. "You took your time," Zuga accused him huskily, still clinging to the door for support. He had left Jan Sharut with the rifle, hidden in a ravine half a mile out across the dusty plain.
"I started running as soon as I heard the shots."
Zuga realized that the fight had lasted only a few minutes, as long as it takes a man to run half a mile. Jan Sharut unslung the water bottle from his shoulder and tried to wash a little of the blood from Zuga's face.
"Leave that,"
Zuga pulled away brusquely. "See if there is a rope in the bastard's saddlebags. Something to tie him. A knee halter. Anything." There was a coil of braided rawhide rope on the pommel of the grey mare's saddle. Jan Sharut hurried back with it and then paused in the door of the derelict shanty.
"I know him."
He stared at Hendrik Nyman's bloody, snoring face.
"I think I know him, but you made such a mess of him."
"Tie him," Zuga whispered, and drank from the water bottle. Then he unwound the silk scarf from around his throat and wetted it from the bottle before tenderly wiping away the blood and dust from his cuts and scratches. The worst injury was in his hairline, where the breech of the broken shotgun had caught him. By the feel of it, it needed to be stitched. Jan Sharut was muttering insults and abuse at Hendrik Nyman as he worked.
"You yellow snake!" he rolled the Greeker onto his back. "You got shoes on your feet and pants covering your black arse, and you think you're a gentleman!"
He pulled Hendrik's arms up behind him and trussed them, quickly and expertly, at wrist and elbow.
"You'd give a vulture a bad name!"
Jan Sharut looped the rawhide around his ankles and pulled it up tight. "Even the hyenas wouldn't eat dung alongside of you, my beauty!" Zuga capped the water bottle and picked up the empty tobacco bag. Then he hunted for the diamonds. They had been kicked and scattered about the kitchen. The eighth and last was the green dragon, dark and inconspicuous in one gloomy corner. Zuga tossed the bag to Jan Sharut, and he whistled as he peered into it.
"IDB,"
he muttered, his wrinkled brown face puckering into a sculpture of pure avarice.
"The yellow snake was IDB.
He wanted us to run those stones across our sorting tables."
"What shares?"
Jan Sharut demanded, playing with the stones.
"Half shares." "That's a good deal. We could be rich in 6 months and get out of this goddamned and blasted desert forever."
Abruptly, Zuga snatched the bag back again. He had been through the temptation once already.
"Get his horse," he ordered angrily.
They hoisted the Griqua's inert body and threw it over the grey's saddle. As Jan Sharut was tying the Griqua to the horse, Hendrik kicked his legs weakly and tried to raise his head, twisting his neck to peer blearily at Zuga.
"Major,"
he croaked, only half-conscious.
"Major, let me explain. You don't understand."
"Shut your mouth," Zuga growled at him.
"Major, I am not a thief. Let me explain about those diamonds."
"I told you to hold your mouth," Zuga warned, and wrenched the Griqua's jaw open, roughly digging his thumbs into the sallow, bloody cheeks. Then he thrust the bag of diamonds into his slack mouth.
"Choke on your bloody diamonds, you thieving, treacherous bastard," he told him grimly,
as he bound the man's mouth closed with his scarf, jamming the bag in place, while Hendrik squawked and rolled his eyes, jerking his head from side to side, his cries muffled, and his spittle soaking the gay band of silk.
"That'll keep you quiet until we get you in front of the committee."
Jan Sharut sat up behind the trussed Griqua on the grey's back and followed Zuga on the gelding. He sucked his teeth mournfully, sighed and shook his head.
"What a waste,"
he grumbled, just loud enough for Zuga to hear.
"That bag would take us back to the north."
He rolled his eyes sideways at Zuga, but there was no reaction.
"The committee is going to see this yellow bastard lynched anyway. He is as good as vulture breakfast already."
Hendrik wriggled helplessly and snuffled through his swollen nose.
If we just did the job for them, nice and quietly, a bullet in the head, and leave him for his brothers and sisters, the jackals and the hyena, man, nobody will ever know.
He glanced hopefully at Zuger again.
What's in that bag will take us north again as far as we want to go.
Zuger kicked the gelding into a canter, and ahead of them the iron roofs and dusty tent cones of New Rush glowed ruddily in the slanting rays of the sunset.
Jan Sharut sighed, swatted the double-laden grey across the quarters, and followed Zuger into the camp. Pickering and Rhodes messed with a few other bachelor diggers directly beyond Market Square, at the edge of the main tailing dumps. There were two good spreading acacias to give them shade, and they had planted a hedge of milkbush around the cluster of iron huts and walled shanties. Every member of the mess owned good claims and was recovering stones. He had to do so to afford the mess bills for champagne and old cognac that seemed to form the group's staple diet. One of them was the younger son of a belted earl. Another was a baronet in his own right, although merely of the Irish aristocracy. Most of them were members of the Diggers Committee, and their style had earned the group the title of the Swells. When Zuger rode into their camp, half a dozen of the Swells were lounging under the acacia trees, dining on Veuve Clicquot champagne, although the sun was still above the horizon, and wrangling amiably over the heavy wages that they were placing against how many flies would settle on the sugar lumps that each had on the camp table in front of him. Pickering looked up, his fair open features for once puckered in astonishment, as Zuger rode into the camp.
"Gentlemen," Zuger announced grimly, "I have something for you."
He leaned out of his saddle and cut the thongs that secured Hendrik Nyman's heels to the saddle girth of the grey mare, and then tipped him off the horse, letting him fall headfirst into the dust in front of the seated group of Diggers Committee members.
"IDB," Zuger told them, as they stared at him.
Pickering moved first. He jumped to his feet.
"Where are the diamonds, Major?" he asked.
"In his mouth."
Pickering went down on one knee next to the Griqua, and he undid the scarf. He worked the saliva-drenched bag out of Hendrik's broken mouth and poured the contents onto the camp table amongst the flies and sugar lumps and champagne bottles.
8!
Rhodes counted them swiftly and looked immensely relieved.
"They are all there?"
"I told you not to worry. I bet 50 guineas on them all being there. Don't forget it."
Pickering smiled at Rhodes and turned back to the Griqua, who was flapping around in the dust like a trussed chicken. Pickering helped him solicitously to his feet.
"My dear fellow," he asked, "are you all right?"
"Ye nearly killed me," Hendrik bleated bitterly. "He's a madman."
"I told you to be careful," Pickering agreed. "He's not a man to trifle with."
He patted the Griqua's back.
"Well done, Hendrik. You did a good job."
Then Pickering turned to Zuger.
"We owe you a little apology, Major."
He spread his hands and smiled winningly. Zuger had been staring at him, unable to speak, his face so pale that his scratches and gouges stood out lividly. But now the scar under his eyes began to glow, and he found his voice.
"A trap," he whispered. You set a trap for me."
"We had to be sure of you,"
Rhodes explained reasonably. "We had to know what kind of man you really were before we got you onto the Diggers Committee."
"You swine," Zuger husked. "You arrogant swine."
"You came out of it with flying colours, sir,"
Rhodes told him stiffly. He was not accustomed to being addressed in those terms.
"If I had fallen for your trap, what would you have done?"
Rhodes shrugged his heavy shoulders.
"The question doesn't arise. You acted like a true English gentleman."
"You'll never know how close it was," Zuger told him.
"Oh, yes, I do. Most of us here have been tested."
Zuger turned to Pickering.
"What would have happened? A lynching party?"
"Oh, my dear fellow, probably nothing so theatrical. You just might have slipped on the roadway and taken a tumble into the diggings,
or had the misfortune to be standing under a gravel bucky when the rope parted? He laughed merrily, and the men at the table laughed with him. You need a glass of Charlie Champers, Major, or something stronger, perhaps.
Do join us, sir, cried another, making room for him at the table. An honour to drink with a gentleman.
Come along, Major, Pickering smiled. I'll send for the quack to see to that cut on your head.
Then Pickering stopped, and his expression changed.
Zuger had kicked his feet loose from the stirrups and jumped down to face him. They were of an even height, both big men, and the group at the camp table was instantly enchanted. This would be more diverting than watching blue bottles settling on sugar lumps.
By gad, he's going to bang Pickling's head. Or Pickling his. 10 guineas the elephant hunter to win.
I don't approve of brawling, murmured Rhodes, but I'll take Pickling for 10.
I say the other horse has run a fair chase already. I do think you might offer some odds.
Pickering's smile had turned frosty, and he was on his toes, his fists clenched, and his guard half raised.
Zuger dropped his own guard and turned disgustedly to the group under the acacia.
I've provided you with enough amusement for one day, he told them coldly. You can take your bloody diamonds, and your damn committee, and you can...
There was a burst of clapping and laughing cheers to cover Zuger's outburst. Zuger swung back onto the gelding's back and kicked him into a gallop, and the ironical applause followed him out of the camp.
I hope we haven't lost him. Pickering lowered his fists and stared after Zuger. God knows we need honest men.
Oh, don't worry, Rhodes told him. Give him time to simmer down and then we'll square him.
Henshaw, Butso held the woven reed basket on his lap and peered into it mournfully.
Henshaw, she is not ready to fight again so soon.
They sat in a circle about the cooking fire in the centre of the thatched beehive. Ralph felt more at home here than in the tent under the camelthorn tree. Here he was with friends, the closest friends he had ever known in his nomadic life, and here also he was beyond the severe and unrelenting surveillance of his father. Ralph dipped into the communal three-legged black pot with his left hand and scooped up a little of the stiff, fluffy, white maize porridge. While he rolled it into a ball between his fingers, he argued with the Matabele princeling opposite him.
If it were you to decide, she'd never fight again, Ralph told him, and dipped the maize ball into the flavouring of mutton gravy and wild herbs.
Her new leg is not strong enough yet, Butso shook his head.
Ralph popped the morsel and chewed as he talked.
The leg is hard and bright as a knife.
Butso puffed out his cheeks and looked even more lugubrious. And on her perch in the shadows behind him, Scipio the falcon shook out her feathers and queated softly, as though in sympathy with him.
Butso's decision, although heavily influenced by Ralph's arguments and by the urgings of the other young Matabele, would be final, for it was Butso who had made the original capture of the animal under discussion.
Every night that she does not fight, we, your brothers, are the poorer.
Camuza came in to support Ralph.
Henshaw is right. She is fierce as a lioness and ready to earn us all many gold queens.
Already you speak and think like a white man, Butso replied loftily.
The yellow coins fill your head day and night. What other reason for that?
Camuza shuddered slightly as he pointed at the basket.
That thing. If it stings you, the spear of your manhood will shrivel like a rotten fruit until it is no bigger than the finger of a newborn baby.
What a shriveling that would be, Ralph chuckled, like a bull hippopotamus shriveling into a striped field mouse.
Butso grinned and made the gesture of placing the tiny basket on Camuza's lap.
Come, let her suckle a little to give her strength for the conflict, he suggested.
And the circle exploded with a roar of delighted laughter at Camuza's patent horror as he yelled and leapt violently away. The noisy jeers covered their own uneasiness at the close proximity of the basket, and they were immediately silent as Butso cautiously lifted the lid. They craned forward with sickly fascination. And in the bottom of the basket, something dark and furry and big as a rat stirred.
How? Inkosikazi!
Batsa greeted it. And the creature reared up on its multiple legs, raising the front pair defensively, and the rows of eyes glittered in the soft, wavering firelight. Batsa lifted his own right hand to return the salute of long, hairy legs.
I see you also, Inkosikazi.
Batsa had named her Inkosikazi, the queen, for, as he explained to Ralph,
she is right royal in her rage and as thirsty for blood as a Matabele queen.
He and Ralph had been unloading timber balks at the eastern end of the new stagings, and as one load had swung upwards in the slings, the great spider had come out from its nest between the sawn planks, and raising its swollen, velvety abdomen, had scampered over Ralph's arm and leapt 10 feet to the ground. The spider was the size of a dinner plate when its legs were extended. Its hirsute appearance and its extraordinary jumping prowess had given the species the common name of baboon spider.
"Get him, Butzer!" Ralph yelled from the top of the loaded wagon.
For now that Griqualand West and the New Rush diggings were part of the Cape Colony and the British Empire, there had been changes. New Rush had been renamed Kimberley, after Lord Kimberley, the colonial secretary in London, and the town of Kimberley was starting to enjoy the benefits of British civilization and Victorian morality, amongst which was the total ban on cockfighting, which was strictly enforced by the new administrator. The diggers, always eager for distraction, had not taken long to find an alternative sport. Spider fighting was the rage of the diggings.
"Don't let him get away," Ralph vaulted down from the wagon, ripping off his shirt,
but Butzo was quicker. He whipped the loincloth from his waist and flared it at the spider like a matador, caping the bull, bringing the huge arachnid to bay on its hind legs, threatening him with its waving arms. Then, naked and triumphant, Butzo had flipped the cloth over it and swiftly bundled it into a bag. Now he slowly but deliberately extended his own finger into the basket, and the spider raised itself higher, the wolf-like mandibles chewing menacingly, and between them the single curved red fang rising from its shallow sheath, a pale droplet of venom shining upon the needle-sharp tip. There was not even the sound of breathing in the dark hut, and the soft tick and rustle of the ashes sounded deafening in the silence as they watched Butzo's open hand draw closer and closer to the creature. Then he touched it with his fingertips and began to stroke the soft, furry carapace. Slowly the spider subsided from her threatening posture, and the watchers sighed and began to breathe again. Inkosikazi had fought 5 times, and 5 times she had killed, although in the last conflict against another huge and ferocious female she had lost one of her legs, chewed through at the elbow joint. That had been almost 3 months previously, but the severed limb had now regenerated itself, and the new leg was lighter coloured than the others, like the fresh shoots on a rose bush. Slowly, Butzo turned his hand palm upwards, and the spider scuttled up into it and crouched there, filling it completely without extending her many-jointed legs.
"A queen," he said. "A veritable queen."
And then, frowning, he told her,
"Henshaw would like to see you fight again."
He glanced up at Rolf, and there was a mischievous twist to his full lips.
"Go to Henshaw and tell him if you will fight or no."
And he offered the spider to Ralph. Ralph felt the crawling of the tiny feet of horror across his skin as he stared at the spider crouching like a hairy toad before his face.
"Come on, Henshaw,"
Batso smiled.
"Talk to her."
It was a challenge, and the watchers stirred with anticipation. If the challenge was not taken up, then their mockery would be merciless. Ralph tried to force himself to move, but his loathing was a cold, nauseating lump under his ribs, and the sheen of sweat on his forehead was suddenly glacially cold. Butzo was still smiling, but the challenge in his direct gaze was slowly changing to taunting disdain. With an enormous effort, Ralph raised his hand, and at the movement, the spider lifted itself and the soft, bloated abdomen seemed to pulse softly, obscenely.